Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we've got a special guest. It's a different type of a program because the guest today is Dr. Nadia Herrera, and she started her career in science at the University of Texas at El Paso a mere 5 years ago. With me in the studio is Ricardo Bernal, Professor Ricardo Bernal. And why is he here? Well, he's a friend, and he's a structural biochemist. And that is exactly the type of study that Nadia Herrera has been doing. And so, Nadia, Ricardo, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you.
Hi, thank you.
Hello, everybody. I'm also Nadia's former mentor.
Yes, he is.
I was going to let that sort of leak out slowly during the program, but since you're proud, and rightly so, that's wonderful. Nadia was an undergraduate student here at UT El Paso and did some very important structural biochemistry with Ricardo before she went to the California Institute of Technology, sometimes known as Caltech, you know, one of the meccas of science in the whole wide world, for her PhD. Okay, Nadia, what was your background before you even became a student? When you were a little girl, were there some reasons that you thought science would be something that would be appropriate for you as a career?
Not at all. My parents didn't really necessarily go to college. All they knew was, like, take you to school and figure it out on your own. So in high school, I started liking science courses more than the rest of them. But there was no clear indicator, like, from year of being 5 years old, for instance, that I was going to be a scientist or anything of that matter.
Which high school did you graduate from?
Coronado High School.
Oh, okay. That's Go just up on the west side.
Yes.
Right? And so you came to UT El Paso as a chemistry or biochemistry major or undeclared and then fell in love?
A little bit of an undeclared major. So the counselors here are very busy counseling many, many students at once during orientation. And so I was counseled to pursue a pre-medical career just because I told them I liked science. And so they said pre-meds go to microbiology. So that's how that happened. But then I quickly did two majors, microbiology and biochemistry.
And what made you think that the opportunity to do research was something that was in line with your stars?
The opportunity to do research came with wanting to actually meet the faculty. A major component of this medical school application would have been to get a recommendation letter from a faculty member. And so I knocked on people's doors, one of them being Professor Bernal's door over here, and I'm like, I need to wash dishes so that I can get a letter from you.
Did you actually put it that way?
Shy of that.
No. So what I remember, and I don't know if you remember this, but she came to see me the first day of classes.
Yeah.
It was actually her first day in college at university. And I was very impressed by that. You know, having somebody on the first day of classes show up to ask to volunteer in a lab. Of course, what am I going to say to that, right? Of course. So that's what I remember.
And did she, in fact, wash dishes?
No, she didn't.
You had a dishwasher.
Well, yes, I had a dishwasher.
That wasn't you, though.
No, a machine.
A machine, I understand. Oh, great. And so do you remember what your first project was with Ricardo? What were you looking at? What was the thrust of the research?
So they were looking at this Groeyel chaperonin, which is responsible for folding misfolded proteins.
And so I think we've done programs on this before, but this is a big sort of it's a meat grinder, you know, unfolded or wrongly folded proteins come in the top. Yeah. They go through this process and they come out in the structure they should have. Mm-hmm. That's the chaperone.
Yes.
Very important molecules.
Very important indeed.
And so that's what you were looking at.
That was the first project, yes.
What were the techniques that you had to utilize in order to do this?
Well, we started growing bacteria with antibiotics. That was the first for me, in order to produce this protein. So we used bacteria to produce massive quantities of this protein so we could structurally characterize it. And so that was one of my first things that I did in his lab, learn how to make protein with bacteria.
And that's, of course, a major part of modern biomedicine these days.
Right.
And the reason that bacteria are used, as opposed to techniques that chemists like me would use, like one reagent in a round bottom flask with another one and so on and so
forth. It's basically the dirt cheap way of basically exploiting bacteria to have them produce your protein.
How do you do that? I mean, you just don't sit down and say, protein, do this, like I would with a graduate student. I mean, bacterium, do this. What's the technique? How does it work?
So you put a little piece of DNA in there, a circular piece of DNA in there that gives the bacteria two things, antibiotic resistance and the ability to express your protein of interest. A bacteria take this up by either a chemical way where you infuse them with calcium chloride that permeates their cell walls and allows the DNA to go inside. The other option is to just electroporate the bacteria and use electricity to temporarily open them and get the DNA inside.
So the bacteria are really sort of very avaricious. You put a little piece of DNA inside and they say, oh, look, food or a structural unit. I don't know what they think. They don't think anything. But this is just the norm. Bacteria function in that manner. So you can put all sorts of little sequences of DNA and they will simply incorporate it into their...
They replicate it. And they replicate it separately from their chromosome.
Why do they replicate it?
You also have a code in that little sequence of DNA to tell it to replicate it.
Okay, so it's not just a random piece of DNA.
No.
You've got something in there that automatically will trick the bacterium into doing their little number.
Correct.
Okay. And how successful were you as an undergraduate? I'll ask you this, and then I'll ask Ricardo.
I would say that from the Grow Yale project, we transitioned into another project that was more of my own. The Grow Yale project was kind of like to get acquainted with the field. My own project was on a lysozyme from a bacteriophage, which is a virus that infects bacteria. And this lysozyme is responsible for digesting the peptidoglycan on the bacterial cell wall in order to allow the virus to introduce its DNA into the bacteria in order to infect it and kill it.
Yeah, that's something that most of us don't really think much about. That is, for viruses, we think of how they impact us. But viruses can attack any living thing, right? I mean, and including bacteria. And maybe we'll come on to this. Were you surprised at how adept this young lady was when she was in your laboratory?
Yes. Actually, she was just very driven. I think that by the end, and correct me if I'm wrong, mm-hmm. but you ended up with three publications as a co-author.
Yeah.
Yeah. So very productive
right.
part of the lab. So she helped out wherever she could. So it just, for me, it was fantastic having somebody, you know, have that attitude.
The habit or the characteristic of hard work and being very industrious. And I've heard stories where you would sometimes, heaven help you, miss class in order to go to the laboratory to do some research, right?
I was in high school.
Right.
I missed a very big exam for my international baccalaureate diploma in order to go to the chemistry lab and synthesize some things.
And did you get your IB diploma?
Yes.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yes.
So it wasn't a total catastrophe?
No.
All right. We'll do a program on the IB program another time for the listener out there. So these habits, were they inculcated from your parents or do you have brothers and sisters that are equally driven like yourself?
So I have one older brother and he's not very fond of school. So I'm the complete opposite of that.
Okay.
I always really enjoyed school and I always knew that the key to success was hard work. My parents, my mom, for instance, held two jobs. While we were growing up, my dad held one job and, you know, they just worked all day, every day. And I learned that in order to do anything, you have to work really hard.
Well, you did. And then you were successful as an undergraduate. And then you went to this mecca of science, Caltech. When you first got there and during your 5 years or 6 years of studying for your PhD, mm-hmm. what struck you most? I mean, did you feel like a fish out of water when you first got there or did you just sort of naturally get into the environment and think, hey, this is my home?
I think it was initially, this is my home. I felt very excited to be surrounded by science. Everybody around you is discussing science. Everybody's very driven by just the sheer essence of discovery. But then quickly it turned around when, unfortunately, I was targeted by the counseling center and by like different offices on campus being like, hey, you're a minority. Don't feel bad. Don't feel like an imposter. It's okay. Here's a brochure to the counseling center. Take it and use it as you need. And so that was very off-putting and that put me off into a kind of like a bit of self-doubt.
And so the assumption was because you were Hispanic, a mm-hmm. Latina, that you would therefore feel sort of cut off to a certain extent from the mainstream of what was going on, and therefore would need counseling.
Yes.
And therefore they tried to provide it to you, even though you didn't need it and didn't feel that way.
Exactly.
And that's because they hadn't had at that stage very many Hispanic students, I suppose.
We are definitely a minority.
You're right. Has it changed any over the 6 years?
No. I was president of the Club Latino over at Caltech, and there were probably five of us.
That's an exclusive club, right?
Yes, very exclusive.
And at the end, it was five at the beginning, it's five at the end, or?
I would say maybe there's like, that I know of, obviously, there's the ones that like to hide in their shell and not expose their Latino heritage, since they will also get targeted by the counseling center. But at the end, I think there were a solid 10 of us.
This is fascinating. I mean, it's sociology more than science. So let's get back to the science. What were you doing there? What was your research project at Caltech?
Yes.
And who were you working with?
I worked in the lab of Professor Doug Rees, and he is a structural biologist. He works on membrane proteins, which are proteins embedded in the membrane that are responsible for transport of nutrients and several different essential things that the cell needs to survive. And he also works on metalloproteins, the nitrogenase protein.
Ah, yes. Molybdenum and iron and
yes.
Good things like that.
What is in the middle of that cofactor is one of the biggest things they discovered while I was there.
And you were involved in this?
No.
Oh, okay.
I was on the membrane protein side of the lab.
We'll take a short break here, and then we'll be back to talk in detail about the research, where it went, and where it's going to go in the future. You're listening to Science Studio. Our guest is Nadia Herrera from Caltech, and my co-host this week is Ricardo Bernal from the University of Texas at El Paso. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. Losing a major limb can be devastating, but what many of us don't know is that a major challenge for amputees is something called phantom pain.
About 70% of amputees live with it and find it debilitating. The pain often and randomly spikes, causing surges of intense pain, interfering with sleep and their daily activities. But a new treatment involving virtual reality may help relieve their pain.
Scientists hooked up electrodes to the stump of arms of 14 patients. These electrodes sent signals from the nerves in the stumps to a computer so that the patient could control a virtual arm that was superimposed onto the patient's stump.
They were trained to use their thoughts to control the virtual arm and drive a virtual car in a race. They also copy the movements of an on-screen arm with their own virtual arm.
After 12 two-hour sessions, the patients had follow-up interviews 1, 3, and 6 months later. Rather than constant pain, these patients reported an average of 50% less pain and impact on their sleep and daily activities.
One patient even felt pain-free periods where his amputated hand felt relaxed rather than constantly clenched.
The training requires the patients to use areas of the brain required for arm movement. Since these areas may be intertwined with circuits responsible for pain perception, the treatment may be disentangling movement from pain.
It also trains patients to use the nerves and muscles in the stump to control the missing limb, even when not hooked to the computer, so the relief could be lasting. If larger studies confirm these results, thousands of amputees will live better quality lives.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discovery shaped the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Ricardo Bernal, and our guest Nadia Herrera from Caltech, who's just completed her PhD there and is now going to talk to us a little bit about the research that you particularly did and how it opened your eyes to future possibilities.
My research focused around the channel and bacterial membranes. And so bacteria require quite a bit of proteins and transporters in order to just survive in the environment that they're in. There's a lot of bacteria in soil that need to survive, as well as, unfortunately, pathogens that need to survive. And one of the stresses that they need to survive is osmotic downshock. Osmotic downshock means that they're all of a sudden infused with water, whether it's soil and it rains, or if it's a pathogen, if it's in your gut, your gut microbiota, for example, it's all microbes. You drink water, you shock them osmotically. And so bacteria have developed quite an elegant way of responding to this osmotic downshock. Instead of taking in all the water, swelling up and exploding, essentially. They take in all the water, swell up, and when their turgor pressure reaches a lytic emergency phase, it activates a cascade of mechanosensitive channels.
And then the water gets shuffled back out.
The mechanosensitive channels gate to that tension in the membrane, and they let everything out.
How does the process prohibit minerals or potassium, sodium, calcium flowing out with the water?
It is an emergency response, so it does not.
Okay, so in an emergency, everything gets evacuated.
Everything gets evacuated.
That's interesting. Are you familiar with this, Ricardo? It's an interesting area in modern structural biology.
Yeah, well, membrane proteins in general are very tough. I mean, they have a reputation of being very difficult to work with.
So the techniques you used to do your PhD study, were they involving some of the things that you learned to do here, or was a whole new sequence of experimental processes?
Actually, I did do a lot of the things that I learned at UTEP over at Caltech. I did work with a membrane protein, and as Professor Bernal alluded to, they are very difficult to work with. And the reason behind that is that a membrane is a lipidic environment. It's kind of like butter.
Yes.
And these
that
proteins,
means fatty, lipidic, right?
Yes. And so these proteins love to be in lipid and fat, and you need to extract them from that to study them and their structure in order to study how they actually do their job in the cell. And so in order to do that, you need to dissolve them in detergents. But you can't just get your Tide from your dishwasher or your clothes and dissolve them. You will actually harm them. So it has to be a very mild detergent. And so we add detergents to all of our protein purifications in order to extract these membrane proteins out from the bacteria that we use to express them.
Okay, and you were successful.
Yes. After 6 years of trying, I screened about what was the equivalent of 4,000 crystals at the Stanford Synchrotron SSRL, Beamline 12-2. They know my lab well there. We screened a lot of crystals and finally got a diffraction pattern, which means that we were able to obtain crystals of this protein, put them in front of an X-ray beam, and have it diffract X-rays to give us information about the electron density around the molecules in the protein.
And the assumption is always there that the structure that you determined was somehow related to the structure that they have when they're doing their work.
That is correct.
Is that still, how would I put it, is that still something that people worry about? We have a lot of structures analyzed, but we're not totally sure that's the way they are when they're doing their function.
I guess X-ray crystallography has been around long enough that enough of these structures have been determined, and further studies have shown that, in fact, you will crystallize the biologically relevant molecule. And in general, usually also when you purify a protein that you're going to crystallize later, mm-hmm. you also check function to make sure that you're working with the correct protein.
Oh, well, I understand that, but you're not necessarily working with that same structure. I mean, it's not a solid phase process.
Well, we also know that the structure of the protein determines function. So they go hand in hand. If a protein loses the three-dimensional structure, it'll affect the function as well.
I guess what I'm thinking of is I can think of this structure, and then I can think of when you put it back into what I will call solution, into a living system, it can have conformational changes, and the functionality comes from a new conformation as opposed to the original one that's in the solid state.
Correct. So if you get the structure of one or two different conformations, that's actually beneficial.
Because did you manage to do that?
So the work that I was doing was follow-up work to the original structure of this channel published in 1998. Actually, nobody's been able to replicate those crystals because that's how much of a challenge it is to actually replicate these results in terms of the type of detergent, the type of water. People say it's in the water. Anyway, nobody's been able to replicate the crystals to diffract to the resolution that was found in 1998, but we can replicate the crystals. After that, people wanted to know what different domains of the protein were doing. And that just means the membrane protein has a part that's in the membrane, it has a part that's in the cytoplasm, and it has a part that's in the periplasm. And these are just different parts of the bacterial cell. And so what I did was try to really determine what the cytoplasmic domain was doing to this protein by completely truncating it from the protein itself.
what are you going to do next? You've sort of been to the mountaintop, you know. You've done wonderful work at one of the most advanced locations in the world. Has that had some impact upon Nadia's idea of a career and her future?
Most definitely it has. I mean, obviously growing up, I didn't know I wanted to be a PhD. Now I am very happy that I have been able to achieve this stage, and I'm going to pursue the path of the academic career. So I want to be a professor one day, and I always enjoyed the idea of being a teacher as a young kid. I enjoyed teaching my peers whatever it was that they couldn't understand or whatnot. And now I look forward to hopefully becoming a professor one day.
Did you get the chance to teach at Caltech, a class or just a laboratory, or is that not part of your program?
I was a TA.
Yeah.
I was a teacher's assistant for various faculty at Caltech. One of them was David Baltimore, and the other one was my own PI, Douglas Reese.
Was this a laboratory TA or actually standing up and giving lectures and all the rest of it?
Yes, so we went to lectures, occasionally held recitation sessions for the undergraduates, and had office hours every week for the undergraduates.
And you enjoyed all that?
It was very enjoyable.
Okay.
They're quite interesting at Caltech.
So I have to just jump in here. And so she said she was a TA, a teaching assistant for David Baltimore. David Baltimore is a Nobel laureate.
Yes, he is.
Earlier in the program, you mentioned this business of viruses sort of infecting bacteria. And I think I've read somewhere that this technique is actually being used somehow to treat people who have bacterial infections where the bacteria are these very drug-resistant materials. Can we talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So bacteria develop drug resistance to the antibiotics that we have made for them. And part of this is that the antibiotics are very old. They were developed in the 50s, 60s. Very few are currently being developed today. And so bacteria have developed a way to get around these antibiotics killing them, and they develop resistance. And so with modern-day infections, they get treated with the first-line spectrum of antibiotics. And if it's a recurring infection, it's probably already resistant to that first line. So you go to second line, and then unfortunately from second line, there's only very harsh antibiotics left. And usually the bacteria are also resistant to them or eventually develop resistance as you're undergoing treatment. And so what bacteriophages are, and they're being used in...
What do you call them?
Bacteriophages.
Bacteriophages, right.
What they are is these viruses that infect bacteria. And there are two types of bacteriophages, the ones that kill bacteria, and then the ones that just kind of live inside bacteria. So the ones that could potentially serve as antibiotics are the ones that kill the bacteria. And it's a little virus that has this tail, this shaft, and these little, like, grippers, like, kind of like, I don't know, spider legs on it. And it carries DNA on it, attaches to the bacteria, inserts its DNA into the bacteria, replicates itself, lyses the bacteria, and kills it. And it continues doing this until the bacteria is all gone.
So the question then comes up that, I mean, and this is being used on people, right? I mean, this
not
technology
in the United
is
States.
Not in the United States, but anywhere?
Only in Georgia, the country.
In Georgia, the ex-Soviet Union.
Yeah.
And so then I would imagine, let me put it another way, if I was suddenly found I'd got tuberculosis with a very drug-resistant form,
yes,
I'd be off to Georgia in a shot. Are people doing that?
There are a few,
yes,
actually. But it's mostly last resort cases that are told in the United States, you know, we're done with treatment, nothing's working. There aren't very many other options. And so they end up traveling to these places for, it's not really experimental therapy, but close to it. And they're treated with the phages and end up being
cured.
Cured, essentially, yeah.
So, I mean, this is a technology and a medication that's out there, but not being used yet in the United States.
Correct.
And the reason?
There's no FDA approval for such treatments in the United States.
Have people tried to get it? I mean, it seems very novel.
It's an area of research that it's curious that it's not being explored further. There's a few labs in the United States looking into it, but it's just a few.
Is that maybe because there's not enough funding from pharmaceutical companies? Because growing viruses is probably less economically useful than growing or making new antibiotics.
It's cheap. It's a little controversial as well because you would be treating people with viruses, and that sort of brings up some fears.
Oh, I can understand that, but as a last resort, as you put it.
Yeah.
But then what happens to the virus at the end when it's gobbled up all the bacteria that it's there for?
Yeah.
What does the virus then do? Is that clever enough to adapt itself and start to attack the host, patient?
It'll usually just hang out and it'll wait for another bacteria until it comes around. And it's actually, so that actually is useful in terms of treatment, because you'll have, it's like an antibiotic that's around all the time.
Yeah.
Okay. But I mean, how does the virus live? Well, we're running out of time, but just very briefly, you say it hangs around waiting for another bacterium. But if there aren't any, because you're cured, then what?
Just stays there. I mean, bacteriophages are everywhere.
I guess potentially it could just degrade and go away, too. But at that point, you know, it's already done its job.
Okay. Well, we're not going to degrade, but we're going to go away. We finished this episode of Science Studio. Nadia Herrera, it's an absolute pleasure to have you back on campus. See you as a full-fledged research scientist now with a career in front of you. And Ricardo Bernal, thank you for starting this young lady on her route to stardom, perhaps.
Oh, it was an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure it is. And finally, I'd like to thank our new producer, I'll say the name very slowly so you're out there, you'll get to know it, Lauren Terrazas. I hope you enjoyed the program. We'll be back next week with another program, and so it goes. Bye-bye.